It used to be that one of my bugbears, to quote Helen McFarland, one of my absolute bugbears was, it's a very common phenomenon. It's authors who say, well, I read that my book was about such and such, but that's wrong, and I should know because I wrote it. I'm like, who the fuck cares what you think your book is about? And that's obviously a tendentious and exaggerated way to put it, but all I'm saying is, like, it is not the end of the story. Like, authorial intention is certainly not irrelevant, but it's not the only thing.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Hello, I'm Daniel Denver, the host of The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. This is the first iteration of Digressions, a series of events that we're doing with Haymarket Books, where we do sort of follow-up conversations with guests that we've had on the podcast. And I'm really excited that China Mieville has agreed to subject himself to being the first experimental subject of this new program. And the questions that I have are questions that we have received in advance from listeners. Also, they've been sort of consolidated, edited, and whatnot by Haymarket. We will put some links in the chat to The Dig, to our Patreon, which is how we fund the podcast, and also to China's website and to Salvage, which is an excellent publication that he runs. China is the author of many, many, many works, but the one that we're discussing today is this really excellent book on the Communist Manifesto, A Specter Haunting, that we discussed on The Dig. China, welcome back.
All right, thank you for having me. And I think I should issue a tiny amendation, which is my comrades would never forgive me if I allowed it to go out that I ran Salvage. I am one of
collectively run.
A collective, yes. That that helps run Salvage.
I mean, to suggest that you exclusively.
My word is law.
All right, let's dive in. The first question that I have here is, one of the pieces of the Communist Manifesto that feels the most outdated is its discussion of the family and gender. Is there anything in Marx's discussion of the subject that you still think is relevant? I'll add, as an addendum to that question, that I find the question interesting because I found in many ways that Marx and Engels' discussion of the family and gender in the manifesto seemed quite heterodox given the reigning orthodoxies of the time in many ways.
Yeah. I mean, the short answer, I am closer to your position than the questioner's position. Thank you for the question, but I'm closer to you, Daniel, on this issue. And in the book itself, I try and go into some discussion about precisely why I do think there's still value in this section. So for a more extended version, I'm going to say this throughout this discussion, I'm sure, but for a more extended version of my position on this, you'd probably have to see the book. But it seems to me that there are three things in particular that I think are still very relevant about this. None of this, incidentally, is to say that there are not problems with it or lacunae or inadequacies, and we'll touch on that as well. The three things that I think are still highly relevant. One is the sheer fury. That it is interesting that, throughout a lot of the manifesto, Marx and Engels are quite playful, and they play rough, but they play, you know, and there's a sort of, there's almost a kind of like, not exactly ironizing, but there is a certain kind of gusto, and you can imagine, it's hard to not imagine them smiling at certain points, you know. Whereas in the discussion of sexism, of women's oppression, the tone is one of really vituperative fury. And you know, one can say, of course, perfectly reasonably, that in some of their you know, personal behavior, they were, you know, less than honorable and did not fill, you know, did not fulfill their own putative position. They were flawed people, like most people. But certainly in terms of their young stated position, their excoriation of women's oppression in the family, and in the family under capitalism, and in the family under capitalism with a kind of a relationship to the workplace and so on, is brutal and furious. And there's something very bracing about that fury, the refusal to be polite. Second of all, I think something that's very relevant is one of the things I try and talk about throughout the book is these places where there are certainly criticisms that should be made of the book, but it doesn't necessarily, not only does it not invalidate the book per se, but a lot of the time, as with lots of rich texts, one needs to kind of deploy the book against the book. And so for me, like, you know, one of the key paragraphs in the book is where it's in the manifesto. They say, the less the skill and exertion of strength implied in manual labor, the more modern industry becomes developed. I'm paraphrasing very slightly. The more the labor of men superseded by that of women. Differences of age and sex have no longer any distinctive social validity for the working class. All are instruments of labor, more or less expensive to use according to their age and sex. This is an astonishing paragraph, because the last sentence and the penultimate sentence basically contradict each other. And they're saying, you know, under capitalism doesn't really care if you're a working class person, it doesn't really care about your sex. And then in the very next sentence, they point out that one of the uses of sex gender to capitalism is that it is differentially paid. So you start with this kind of vicious, furious criticism of the bourgeois family and of the exclusion traditionally of women from the kind of the social and public realm. And then it talks about how in the context of capitalism's development, women are pulled into that realm. And rather than just saying, well, the book is contradictory and therefore flawed, there's a really interesting way, excuse my cat, this is going to keep happening. There's a really interesting way in which both of those things are true, that there is this abstraction that gets spread through the workplace. But nonetheless, and this is the vein that Marx and Engels traditionally underplay, and certainly in the manifesto, gender becomes constitutive of the value of labor power itself. And this is, I think this is really, really rich, because what it does is it kind of opens up the idea of, you know, a rigorous and necessary gendering of class, not, as I've said before, the kind of adding of class and gender and stirring like a cup of tea, but like the kind of the deep structuring of axes of gendered oppression to the realities of class itself, including its kind of labor, its value. Is there in the manifesto, even though its own authors don't necessarily seem to notice that. So another aspect that I think is very relevant and rich is precisely certain aspects that the authors don't seem to clock themselves. And the final thing I would say I think is very relevant, and I wanted to talk about this more in the book, and I didn't have space, and it became too, I had to cut it, but I think is really interesting, is broadly speaking, what they talk about a lot is what capitalism promises, and then the way that that promise is, it's a promise structured around a set of bourgeois realities, so that the promise is itself a kind of snare. So, for example, you talk about bourgeois freedom, and you know, what that actually means is the freedom to own private property, the freedom to you know, to control the means of production and so on. And in the section on gender, more than at any other section, they advert to something else that goes on under capitalism and under bourgeois society that I think is really interesting and that I haven't seen as developed as I'd like, including by myself, which is constitutive hypocrisy. Because it's not only that capitalism like makes these promises that don't actually mean what you think they mean. It's also the case in certain axes that capitalism promises things and then constitutively breaks its own promise all the time, as in the case of particularly they talk about that in the case of gender, where there's this kind of constitutive hypocrisy about the kind of idolization of womanhood and the kind of the social niceties and so on, predicated on the same time as the absolute breaking of that all the time. So when they talk about, you know, the bourgeoisie bed hopping, they're not only saying, you know, in a kind of vaguely moralistic way, you know, you're all hypocrites and so on. They're also saying there's something structuring about the family under capitalism that there is this, at least traditionally, we can debate about this today, there is this kind of deep investment in an ideology of kind of controlling monogamy. But that ideology, it's not just that the ideology itself is toxic, as with a lot of capitalist ideology, it's also an ideology that its own proponents constantly break. And that sort of, I think there's something about structuring and constitutive hypocrisy as a sort of, as a social force rather than as an individual failing, that I think is really rich and is something that that I think this section opens up in quite an interesting way.
Yeah, a few follow-ups that come to mind from that question. One is that I hope to ask you about, but didn't have time. I didn't have time during the interview for, you know, a dozen questions. But, you know, at some point, Marx and Engels, you know, they phrase these sorts of attacks that their enemies have launched against them. And one of them is that communists are, you know, proponents of free love, essentially. Mm-hmm. Most of the attacks that they're sort of you know, quoting the bourgeoisie is launching against them, they sort of, I don't know, I feel like they sort of accept and they're like, yes, true, and you should be afraid of us. But are they like opponents of monogamy or advocates of free love, or what are they doing there?
The manifesto itself certainly doesn't have a worked out position on this. And I think that's all to the good. I think it'd be catastrophic if it did, whatever position it ended up taking. But it's certainly true that they treat the kind of default accusation of like wanting I think the phrase they use is a community of women or something, essentially a kind of free love utopia, as a nursery fable. But this gets also to this point about constitutive hypocrisy, because this is also part of their thing about, you know, you act as if, you know, free love and the breaking of monogamous commitment is this kind of ultimate sin. And yet look at you, at a kind of structural level. So when they bring up sex work, they're not just saying, oh, you're all such hypocrites, there's lots of sex workers. They're saying like there is something constitutive about capitalism that it is simultaneously saying sex work is the worst, you know, the worst ethical catastrophe ever, while also like making it absolutely necessary and generative that this is this is a large sector.
So what's the cause or function of that constitutive hypocrisy?
Well, this is a much bigger conversation, and I mean I don't think I can do more than just kind of gesture at it now. But I do think I'm really interested. The short answer, I guess, is I don't know. I mean, there's a very simple way in which one can say, you know, capitalists are invariably hypocrites. And sure, yes, and I'm not disputing that. But I think there is a difference, for example, between saying, you know, capitalism is about freedom, but freedom doesn't mean what you think it means. It actually means this other thing. It actually, you know, there is a specific version of capitalist freedom. That's one thing, and that's one way ideology works. And then the other way ideology works, I mean, I think to answer your question, I would probably want to start bringing in some psychoanalytical tools here in terms of a kind of disavowal, because another way capitalist ideology works is not just to assert something that has a very particular meaning and then try and disseminate it, but is also to sort of assert norms which it structurally undermines, so that there is a, you know, there is a kind of whether you think of it in terms of a pressure valve, whether you think of it in terms of a death drive, whether you think of it in terms of what, you know, however you think of it, I think there's something about social denial that is important. Excuse me.
Another thing that I wanted to ask you about during our interview that your question brought to mind is to what extent is Marxism, and this is a me question, not a listener question. We'll get back to the listener questions in a moment. To what extent is Marxism about, in some fundamental way, an imminent critique of liberalism and thus socialism or communism, a project of universalizing this promised but in reality extraordinarily exclusionary form of freedom capitalism offers?
I mean, I think this is a really interesting question. To some extent, I think it's the question. And I think that, and I'm gonna of course, try and have it both ways, which will be very unsatisfactory to a lot of people. But all I can say in my defense is that I want to have it both ways because I think it is in fact both ways. And I also think that as a general rule, in social theory in general, and including on the left, for all that we talk about contradiction, we don't enough engage with how constitutively contradictory capitalism is. So a lot of the culture war stuff, including on the left, ends up being about, is this way or that way the way to be progressive, as opposed to a notion that both of these are different ways to be interpolated by capitalism, and that is about the structure that underlines that. That is about the arena on which these are choices. And I think there's often a dialogue of the deaf. So to answer your question, an enormous amount of like debating on the left is often around, like, you know, is capitalism essentially a kind of radicalized liberalism, or is capitalism antinomian and about the refusal of all bourgeois and liberal values? And I'm afraid I think it's both. It depends on context. It depends on what exactly we're talking about. And, you know, I can use some kind of Hegelian fairy dust and talk about dialectics, but I just don't think it's particularly mysterious that this is a, you know, porque no los dos.
Okay, returning to listener questions. One listener writes, taking your advice to learn from our enemies, are there any critiques of the Communist Manifesto from the right that are worth reading? And I'll add just like also from right or anywhere.
I thought this was such an interesting question. And I mean, there's lots of interesting, Lasky's work on the Communist Manifesto, like one can disagree with it, but still get a lot out of it and find it very interesting and so on. But I'm going to focus on one piece in particular. And I tried to take the spirit of the question and think about something that I like really fundamentally disagree with and think is pretty toxic, but also think is very interesting. And the piece is by Murray Rothbard, the notorious Austrian school libertarian right economist, and he wrote a piece called Karl Marx, Communist as Religious Eschatologist, in which essentially the project of the piece is to argue Marx is actually a kind of religious messianic writer. This is actually about a kind of political eschatology, the kind of science of last things. This is actually just a kind of, you know, cult-like religious faith. And actually, it's not a kind of grounded social theory at all. And he means this almost entirely as a gotcha.
Right.
But I really like the essay for a couple of reasons. I mean, a couple of caveats. It's got a lot of bullshit in it. I mean, like theologically, it's incredibly tendentious and sort of ill-educated and so on. I mean, like, you know, if you're going to sort of take what he says about religions seriously, there's an enormous amount of rough edges. But for one thing, as anyone who's read the book knows, I'm very interested in and non-defensive about the idea of relating to Marxism in part as precisely as an eschatological movement. I think I think this is true. I think that the utopian elements within Marx are not reducible to a kind of quasi-religious messianism or apocalypticism, but they are absolutely inextricable from it. And I have no problem with that at all. And I don't think that is contradictory to rigor. I don't think it's contradictory to political radicalism in the slightest. And I think it's part of the rich tradition. So there is a sense in which on that observational level, Murray Rothbard's piece is more accurate about the reality of Marxism than a lot of more defensive, if you like, cold stream Marxist work, economistic Marxist work, which is very defensive about the idea of Marxism's relationship to religion. And the second thing is, more concretely, I'm tempted to say by accident, because I don't have a lot of respect for Murray Rothbard intellectually, but the specific contours of the religion, of the religious tradition that he identifies, which he really interestingly, he coins a phrase. Let me see if I can find it. He's talking about the kind of theology it is, and he talks about it as reabsorption theology. And he's talking about a kind of theology that I would largely use the term apophatic theology. And I think his actual model of reabsorption theology is very weird, but it's not uninteresting. So I think he's wrong, but I think he's very interestingly wrong. And that tradition that I think of as apophatic theology is by far the most interesting theological tradition to me. So both in the fact that he's pointing at religion and in the specific contours of the religious figures he's talking about, like Plotinus, like Meister Eckhart and so on, I think it's an accidentally really perspicacious essay. And it's quite fun to read because it's a polemic, and it's a wrong polemic, but, polemics can be fun.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't be too surprising that, like, any, not just communism or Marxism, but any form of politics that's a mass politics, that it has, that it extends beyond sort of like dry social scientific calculations.
Yeah, and we might get onto this, but in the very specific genealogy of the Communist Manifesto in particular, but also the communist movement in general, I think that the continuities as well as the breaks with radical religious traditions are just unarguable. And again, that's fine. That's only a problem if you have a very specific and, I think, narrow and wrong notion of what religion is and the way it works.
A fun question. Can you explain why anyone would think Frightful Hobgoblin is a better translation than Spectre?
For context here, the very first English translation of the Communist Manifesto was translated by Helen MacFarlane, a completely fascinating radical figure. And Marx and Engels were at times quite rude about her translation, but also, and this is often missed out of the discussions, at times really lauded it and thought it was very important and tried to order copies so that they could send them to English-speaking comrades and so on. And she famously did not translate the first sentence as, a spectre is haunting Europe. She translated a spectre as a frightful hobgoblin. And the short answer is no, I can't. I think it's a pretty poor translation. What I will say in Helen MacFarlane has a lovely, strange poetic register, and even if one can argue with the rigor of some of her translations, it is rich and interesting to read. She coins a word shopocrat at one point, a shopocracy and stuff, and it's interesting. The only thing I can say in defense of the Frightful Hobgoblin, and also she then translates Gespenst as bugbear, like the sort of fable monster, is that she is drawing on something real in that section, which is that Marx and Engels are mocking their detractors for essentially telling nursery stories. And the register of the way they attack them is that, it's like you're telling a horror story, which is completely overwrought and ridiculous. But it's also like you're trying to scare children at night, like you're reading a fairy story. And so what she's doing is she's leaning into the fairy story rather than the gothic element of that section. And where everyone else, I think more accurately, has leaned into the gothic, she is sort of essentially mocking the enemies for telling fairy stories about their enemies, i.e. her. So that's the defense I can offer, along with the fact that it's an extremely winning translation, even if an eccentric one.
Yeah. Okay, the next question sort of circles back to the question I asked a few moments ago about whether Marxism can be understood as an imminent critique of liberalism. I was surprised to see a defense of freedom occur at several points in your book. I've always considered it so spoiled by libertarians and neocons as to be reclaiming. What do we get out of defending freedom rather than just pushing for democratic socialism? And before you answer, I would definitely direct curious listeners to an interview I did many, many, many years ago with Aziz Rana on his book, The Two Faces of American Freedom. And it, there's a whole kind of tradition of left scholarship around, you know, this these ideas. Also, Alex Horovitz's work on radical labor in the late 19th century U.S. But yeah, what do you think?
Well, it's a really interesting question. If you like, there's an intellectual question and there's a strategic question. And strategically, the argument essentially goes, whatever we think intellectually, this term is simply too toxic now from the left, and we have to avoid it. And if that's the nature of the question, I would respectfully disagree. I think this is not a principled position. I'm not averse to the idea that there may be terminology that whatever we think about it in our souls is just so ruined by the Overton window that we can't deploy it anymore. But I don't think freedom is one of them. And in fact, for me, the opposite is the case. I think it is a very strong case against capitalism that it is predicated on mass unfreedom. And it is this is one of those areas about liberalism, as you say, right, in which the critique of capitalism is inextricable from capitalism as emerging out of, rather than merely contradicting, liberalism, is that bourgeois society offers freedom which it will never universalize. It constitutively is predicated on not universalizing it, and indeed on mass unfreedom. And so precisely because the terms of freedom are very common for understandable reasons, I think it's very important to say that capitalism is, you know, the most extraordinarily powerful engine for mass unfreedom that exists. It is quite remarkable. So there's a strategic disagreement. And on an intellectual level, and again, I'm not leading with this because there is a legitimate strategic question, but simply intellectually, I think that, you know, Marx and Engels and the Marxist tradition, from its inception through to now and through the whole of Marx's life and Engels's life, was predicated, even if they didn't always seem to realize this, on a relationship to the absolute necessity of mass freedom, of liberation, of emancipation. And here I draw quite a lot on Stephen Lukes, who writes about Marx's morality of emancipation, which Marx is in denial about the fact that he has, but clearly has, if you read it carefully. And that, you know, the German, forgive my pronunciation, but like Freiheit, recurs, you know, it's there in the Communist Manifesto, precisely distinguished from bourgeois freedom, the same word, that it's like, this is what you say you're into freedom, this is what you mean by freedom, but what we want is an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. In Capital 3, decades later, he talks about the realm of freedom, repeatedly about the realm of freedom as essentially like the only thing worth going for, what this is all about, the horizon. And this goes back to, you know, arguments about, well, discussions about freedom versus necessity in the 1844 manuscripts, like before the manifesto. So in principle, intellectually, freedom is central to the Marxist project. And in terms of strategy, I respectfully disagree that we should cede this terrain. In fact, I think we should be much bolshier than we have been about this terrain. Mm-hmm. I think we should say it is we who fight for freedom, and you are committed to its eradication, you libertarians, you right wing, you capitalists.
Yeah, and just on the intellectual point, what Marx is doing is really indicting freedom as really an heir to long-standing visions of freedom that are premised on slavery, essentially, right? The subordination of others rather than like a true universalization of freedom that allows for the free development of everyone.
Yeah, and I mean this is the dirty history of liberalism that, you know, people like Lucerdo have written about, and there's a poem I quote in the book about, you know, a poem explicitly lauding liberty on the grounds that it will fill our warehouses with slaves. You know, this is the liberty that is that is inherited, if you like, by like high capitalism, and that it built and inherited by high capitalism that it proffers, but it You know, and so, you know, I want to kind of constantly hammer away at the fact that, you know, their freedom versus ours, if you like.
We have a question from Amanda, who is listening now. I want to hear more about, quote, women's work, work that is vital for society to function, but is paid the least or expected to be provided free of charge, how that fits into this discussion about Marx's views, childcare, care of disabled people, housework, how can these workers be liberated? And I'll add to that question, is there a sort of nascent analysis of social reproductive labor in Capital or elsewhere in Marx's work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to answer this at great length, partly because we could go on, partly because this is not, there are many people who are much more versed in the weeds of these debates and so on than I. But in brief, and also I don't want to stray too far from the manifesto itself in this particular discussion. And I think it's fair to say that the manifesto, one of its problems, one of its inadequacies, one of its lacunae, it's precisely that it doesn't go into this in much detail. Now, that doesn't mean that there's nothing to be said about it. And I think it's a great question. And what I would say is that this is, it's related exactly to what I was saying before, that I think this is where we have to read the text against itself, and that we absolutely can start to extract arguments about this and positions about this from the text. But A, they are underdeveloped, and B, they are often, their own authors don't clock that they're there. They don't, you know, and that this is where our job is to be a kind of comradely, rigorous, sympathetic, but ruthless archaeologist and sort of say, well, Marx and Engels may or may not have known they were saying this, but this is implicit in what they're saying. And very simply, that passage that I read, you know, the fact that their whole argument about the mass entry of women into the workforce under capitalism, under the capitalism that they focus on as an abstracting force and as a sort of generalizing force, the fact that they predicate that on the idea of differential payment is absolutely constitutively an argument about social reproduction. It is absolutely constitutively an argument about the nature of the work that women are supposed to do, the way their work is related to as capitalist workers, and what that means about the way they are related to as workers on a broader level, what their quote real jobs are, what their real work is, et cetera, et cetera. So I can't and won't go into like loads and loads of detail, but I think, I mean, to a certain extent, I think it was Amanda who asked this, like, it is a perfectly reasonable criticism of the book that it doesn't go into this enough. But I also think that it would be inadequate to sort of say there's nothing about this in the manifesto. I think the point is that the manifesto, in certain respects, doesn't quite know all the stuff it has. And it is interesting to sort of try and draw out some of these threads that I think are nascently there.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism, Debates in the Second International, 1900 to 1910, edited by Mike Tabor. At its height, from 1889 to 1914, the Second Socialist International represented the majority of organized workers in the world, with the revolutionary goal of overthrowing capitalism. Its major accomplishments, such as the 8-hour day and International Women's Day, testify to its lasting influence around the world. In this important collection of debates at Congresses of the Second International, Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism captures the International's vibrancy and gives a snapshot of its strengths, weaknesses, and contradictions. As David McNally puts it, this book is a treasure chest for every socialist seeking to understand the history of their movement. Bringing together documents from 1900 to 1910, Mike Tabor shows us how socialists more than a century ago analyzed and debated key questions of their time. Find Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism at haymarketbooks.org.
Yeah, I mean, relatedly and along similar lines, there's, you know, repeated arguments about the inexorable globalization of capitalism that are maybe not that part is of the kind of the emerging capitalist world system. The fact that that is trending towards a world system is repeatedly emphasized in the manifesto, and it does not give us an entire kind of world systems theory of how capitalism operates, but it sort of lays the does lay the groundwork or perhaps lead us towards such an analysis.
Absolutely. And I should say here, in case it sounds like I'm arguing for special pleading for the manifesto, this is how I think all texts should be read. Like, I think that, you know, all texts need to be read against themselves in terms of their contradictions, in terms of not only what they say, but what they don't realize they're saying, et cetera, et cetera. But it is also very true that that kind of contradiction and ambiguity and that kind of ambiguity is not the right term. I would say more like the kind of proliferation of voices is particularly present in highly performative works. And they are therefore more present, I would say, and more rich and more deserving of that kind of reading in a manifesto, let alone a kind of declarative, performative, almost incantatory manifesto, than they are in a geography textbook, or they are in Capital Volume 2. And it's not to say they're not there, but they're not there in the same way and to the same extent. So I'm not saying, like, this is the way to read Marx. I'm saying I think this is the way to read. And one of the problems of a lot of the discussion in the manifesto is that it doesn't read it that way. And, you know, more even than a lot of other books, it needs to be read that way, both to criticize it and to understand it and to learn from it and to praise it.
Yeah, I mean, to just ask one more question along those lines, obviously you write a wider array of genres of work than many people who write for a living. What sort of... Why is the manifesto for you this opportunity to make a general argument about how we should read?
That's a really good question. I'm very frustrated with a lot of the state of, like, sort of general discussions about how we read. I think in terms of, like, the default notion of authorial intention as the only thing that, you know, a text is about, you know, like, what did the author really mean in terms of, like, the seeking for, like, the code that tells you what the book is really about, all these things. And there's a weird contradiction, which is, on the one hand, especially in, like, maybe in the academy or among people who, like, study literature for a living or who've read some of this stuff, it's more or less taken for granted, I think rightly, that these are completely inadequate heuristics of reading. And yet at a sort of popular discursive level, they're constantly ignored as if we haven't had these discussions. And so it used to be that one of my bugbears, to quote Helen McFarland, one of my absolute bugbears was, it's a very common phenomenon. It's authors who say, well, I read that my book was about such and such, but that's wrong. And I should know because I wrote it. I'm like, who the fuck cares what you think your book is about? You know, like, I mean, and that's obviously a tendentious and exaggerated way to put it. But all I'm saying is, like, it is not the end of the story. Like, authorial intention is certainly not irrelevant, but it's not the only thing. And also, authorial intention is never monolinear. There's always contradictions and so on. So you're absolutely right in what you imply, that this is a kind of general exasperation I have with the way a lot of discussion about reading is often carried out. But the manifesto discussion, the manifesto was a really great way into talking about that in general, because, as I say, for a variety of reasons. One is, I'm not arguing for a kind of flat terrain where all books need to be read in the sense that they all mean everything. That's ridiculous. That's like a child's parody of postmodernism. No one sensible is saying that. But I am saying that, like, some books, if you like, are more fecundly polyvocal than others because of their form. And a manifesto is an incredibly rich form. And so it is true, I think, that this book in particular, among Marx's and Engels' work, really deserves and demands that kind of reading. And related intimately to that, and I think I said this in our interview, is because I would say the majority of the criticisms of, and indeed many of the praises of the book, don't approach it that way. They are of staggeringly poor quality. Most criticisms of the Communist Manifesto are just really unworthy. They're embarrassing because they don't approach it with that kind of reading, I think. And it's not beyond criticism at all. But these critics, sort of like, you know, well, Marx says, he uses the word inevitable here, and the communist and the revolution didn't happen, therefore this book is proven wrong. It's just stupid. So, you know, you are right if I infer what you're asking, that there is an excuse to some extent in this book to sort of smuggle in a kind of slightly exasperated manifesto for a more supple reading technique in general.
Amanda has a follow-up question, which is asking what authors one would recommend to read about gender and capitalism, and I guess social reproduction in particular, and two books that I have done interviews on that come to mind, and then I'll turn it over to you. One is a very short, smart book, Feminism for the 99%, A Manifesto from Verso by Cynthia Rutza, Tithi Bhattacharya, and Nancy Fraser. And then Tithi Bhattacharya also has a book called Social Reproduction Theory that she edited. I guess it's if I recall correctly, it's an edited volume. China, what do you think?
I mean, Brenna Bandar and Rafif Ziadeh's recently collected volume, I forget the title, for a more specific topic, Sophie Lewis's book Full Surrogacy Now it's on family abolition, but it touches on a lot of these issues. But I would say, because, you know, when one's put on the spot, well, I don't know about you, but when I'm put on the spot, you know, all the names in my head like run off in all directions. So what I would suggest to Amanda is that if you take a look around on, well, the Haymarket website, the Haymarket Books website, and all the Verso Books website, they both have, I think, collections of socialist feminist literature recommendations and social reproduction reading. There's a lot of really fascinating stuff, and particularly in the last few years, there's been a kind of resurgence of this tradition that is really worth engaging with.
Yeah. There's also in my partner Theoria Francos and a few other authors a few years ago wrote this book, A Planet to Win, and one of the authors, Alyssa Battistoni, has done a lot of work on social reproductive labor and thinking through that in particular in terms of the energy transition, what it would require to build a kind of low carbon luxurious society that instead of consuming lots of cheap shit involves like tons of care work, tons of socially rich experiences.
Which gets to a later question, actually, but I won't presume.
I don't blame you not enjoying getting put on the spot. That's why I put other people on the spot for a living. Okay, let's move on to, I think, the one sort of art history question we have. I found your interpretation of the painting in the book deeply moving and convincing. Have others read the image this way? And can you speak to its origins, how you came across it? I think we can put that, it's a poster, I believe, a Russian poster from shortly after the revolution.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a poster by V.V. Spassky, and it's called To the Lighthouse of the Communist International. It's from 1919. I came across the book, the image in Enzo Traverso's book, Revolution and Intellectual History, from 2021, which is a beautiful, magnificent book. For those who, I don't know if we can see the image, but basically it's an image of a kind of emaciated person on a raft who has escaped from a sinking ship and is making their way towards the far off distant light of a lighthouse. And I'm grateful to the question. It's an extraordinary image, a very beautiful, very melancholy image. So that's where I found it. And I have not, in fact, I have had a little look around and I have found very little discussion of it. There may be some classic work that I have just not seen, but there's not that much discussion of it that I can find. Essentially it's aiming to kind of validate. Oh, I forgot to mention the key thing, which is that the raft the person is on is an open copy of the Communist Manifesto. And it's sort of eulogizing the Communist International, the organization to kind of, you know, spread Marxist communism internationally in the early 20th century, and seeing hope in that. And my discussion of it was based on Enzo Traverso's brief mention of it, where and he says the message of the poster is clear. The socialist future is not compromised, since the Communist International embodies a light of hope. And again, to reiterate, I think it's a magisterial book and a brilliant one. But I did, you know, in a comradely fashion, disagree with Enzo about this in one sense, which is that I think the picture is vastly more melancholy than that implies. And it's interesting, both his discussion and mine, there's a certain kind of political ambiguity about the symbolism of the ship, and I think this is partly because a lot of the reproductions are not very clear. But there's basically a, you know, is it about the collapse of the Second International, the social democratic parties who basically voted for the war, or is it about the collapse of Stalinist Russia? And he says he thought it was more likely to be the Second International. Now, subsequently, I've seen other reproductions which make the colors of the flag slightly clearer, and it does appear to be a Russian flag. But even there, on the ship, I mean, even there, there's ambiguity, because it is not actually the classic Tsarist flag. It doesn't have the kind of yellow eagle in the corner that it would have had at that time, and it's very faint. And as I argue in the book, this is, you know, germane to our last question, the intent of the author is important, but it's by no means the only thing. And you can read this as a representation of Russia more generally, and particularly the Russia of 1919, which is, you know, a year and change into, you know, post-revolution and in a grotesque and barbarous civil war. And so there's a great melancholy to it, in the sense that this figure is kind of adrift, potentially away from the kind of sinking of a socialist polity itself. And the thing that I find most moving about it is that, yes, you can see the signal, but the signal is a long way off, and you've got a long way to go. And this book is keeping you afloat, but the sea is very dark and very big, and it's night, and it's by no means assured that this person is going to get there. And that seems to me to be, a very moving and very powerful, and in some ways very honest relationship to the nature of socialist activism, particularly then, but also more generally. So that's the origin for me of that image. No, I don't know very much more about it than what I've been able to find from Enzo's book and from online searches.
There is a second question about art. As a writer of fiction with an undeniable radical core, what do you think is the relationship between art and politics? What contribution can writers and artists make to revolutionary movements? Given the power and prominence of capitalist realism, doesn't their role seem more important than ever?
I can't answer this question without repeating myself, because I get asked this quite often, and I want to ask the indulgence and forgiveness of people who've heard me respond to variations of this question before. The short answer is, I want to quote Shirley Collins, who is a folk musician, a fairly legendary folk musician here in the UK, and she was recently interviewed. And the question was, folk music used to be a potent political tool. Does it still have that power? And remember, this is a woman who has, you know, who'd come out of that sort of, you know, radical folk tradition and has pursued it her whole life with complete rigor. And her response was, potent political tool, I would say my arse, if you wouldn't mind. For me, Pete Seeger bashing his bloody banjo and exhorting an audience to join the chorus of We Shall Overcome never seemed to advance any causes. It just made people feel they were taking part in something. Now, I basically agree with that. What I don't think follows is that, you know, making people feel they're part of something is in and of itself a bad thing to do. I also want to be super clear that I'm neither the cops nor am I a psychoanalyst, and I don't know what works of fiction or art or anything may motivate individual people. And as far as I'm concerned, whatever gets you up in the morning, whatever gets you through the day, particularly if you're a radical and you know, life is exhausting. And if you happen to find particular writing, self-consciously leftist or not, inspiring, great, have at it. But I balk very, very strongly from the idea that constitutively art, fiction, music are radical acts, or that they tend in any inevitable way towards radicalism. I think sociologically it does, let alone actually moving history, let alone actually changing things. I think sociologically it doesn't follow, because there are plenty of people whose politics I agree with, who have what I think is a dreadful taste in art. There's plenty of political leftist art that I think is just embarrassingly awful. There's art, the politics of which are incredibly complicated, that I personally, like, I always have this anecdote, and it sounds like I'm being pretentious. I probably am being pretentious. It sounds like I'm being pretentious and tendentious, but I promise you it's true, is that to me, one of the key, like, radicalizing art pieces in my life that changed my relationship to the everyday is Beatrix Potter's picture of Jeremy Fisher, the frog, sitting on a lily pad with a trout coming up underneath him. And I can construct a whole argument about the relationship to the sublime and so on in that picture. And I'm not saying it's not true, but what I am saying is that the idea that, like, there's anything inevitable about Jeremy Fisher being a radical text or anything like that, it just doesn't follow. The lines of mediation between the way people receive art and how it makes them feel, and the intentions of the artist, and the unconsciousness of the artist, and the political unconscious of society, are simply so tangled that the relationship of art and activism, I think you cannot draw general conclusions to it. And I will go further and say that I think the hankering for that on the left is a sign of dreadful weakness. And the constant questions that people ask each other and ourselves, you know, the constant assertions about the actually the radical politics of, you know, this or that X-Men film, or, you know, yeah, I really, really liked this album because the politics were really great. This is an expression of our political weakness. Yeah. And so what I would say to the questioner is, read whatever you love, watch whatever you love. If you find it inspiring, if it excites you, including politically, fantastic. But art will not save us, and that's not its job. To be disappointed by it for not doing that is a category error. And we will know that we are strong as a political movement when we are not nearly so concerned to validate the art we like by saying that actually we agree with its politics.
Yeah, and I was just going to ask about just that, because it seems like, especially on social media, especially on Twitter, there's so much debate over whether the politics of a given, especially like pop cultural, you know, work are good or bad, you know, whether Barbie is a feminist text, or whether it's fundamentally about making the world safe to sell, for selling millions and millions of Barbies around the globe. And it's obviously, like, you know, fundamentally about, you know, making money for Mattel, but I'm planning on seeing it next week, but I'm also, you know, not planning on posting about it.
Well, I mean, you know, what I'm not, just to be clear, because people get very defensive about this, and there's a lot of, like, I think, sort of creaky thinking about this. I am not in any way saying anything against political readings of art. Like, I love a good political reading of art. You know, I'm totally pro that. What I'm against is either using our art as proxy for politics, which I think, as I say, is hugely an expression of weakness. And to use your Barbie example, I think the other thing is, one of the things about art, to get back to what we've been saying about manifestos and all this, is not saying that all readings are equally valid, but it is absolutely the case that, you know, art and creative fiction and writing and so on are, you know, are doing more than one thing. So 95% of these idiotic debates about, is this film radical or is it, you know, conservative? It's like, probably both. Like, probably both. This is not rocket science. This is kind of, you know, the political unconscious 101. This is like radical art theory 101. Like, yeah, and that's okay. You can still enjoy it, but, like, you know, or hate it. Yeah. But the idea that you're going to be able to extract the real politics, let alone therefore it's going to be part of the struggle, is just bananas. I shouldn't say it's bananas. It's weakness. It's because we're weak and we're desperate for wins. And I get that. I'm not saying this because I have no empathy for it. I'm just saying it's a snare.
Bananas, speaking of internet debates on the left,
oh, God,
found super helpful recently. Both sides on that. Like,
Well, I mean, because I'm not on social media, I miss most of these things, and I'm
someone
fine.
Someone put you in on the bananas debate.
Yeah, I some of them filter through to me, and that's fine. I just kind of have this also gets to some of the questions that people have asked, but I feel like, as you say, there are some really interesting elements to the debate. But to me, right. The idea that we're going to be able to solve this or figure out the correct position is predicated on a complete misunderstanding of what it is to be a radical who wants a ruptural politics. So, and also there's also that thing, which is a very obvious thing to say, but the weird metastatic vituperation of these debates is another right. sign of our weakness.
Right, right. And the idea that it's like so consequential what the answer to it is when both sides of the debate over whether or not there'll be bananas in the global north under communism are, perhaps operating under the maybe something attractive about the debate is that we're a lot closer to a rupture towards communism than than we realistically are.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm all for kind of speculative debates.
But someone else's throat over a speculative debate. It's not, the stakes are not what people think they are.
And it's heartbreaking because I really do think these are pathologies of a long historic weakness of the left. And I look forward to us not behaving like this in these discussions because it will bespeak a growing confidence, it seems to me.
Well, if we take this a little further, I mean, on one hand, I sometimes feel like, discourse and ability to debate on the left, whether we're talking about the kind of tenor of debate within DSA or on Twitter more generally, on the one hand, it feels like, often horrific, but on the other hand, is this just like, is this, to put it, to understate it, a recurrent problem on the left that certainly predates Twitter? Or are things, worse now? Or are they just exactly the same on new platforms?
I mean, I don't know, obviously, but my suspicion is it's not exactly the same. No, I think it would be strange if it would not be very materialist, if you like, right. to think that like right. these massive changes in the means of production would have no psychosocial right. payoff. And it seems to me that it's certainly not the case that these pathologies are created by Twitter or anything like that. But I do think it's also the case that social media has social media and more generally kind of platform capitalism and the digitization of neoliberalism and the neoliberalization of the digital and so on have lowered the barrier to entry to these pathologies, B, validated. I'm saying pathologies in a slightly provocative way, but I mean, like, I do feel that they are overwhelmingly pretty negative. They've validated them. In some cases monetized them, but not always about money. Sometimes it's about a different kind of remuneration. So no, I don't think that these are created by them, but my hunch is that they are exaggerated and built by them. And that troubles me. It would be facile to say that there's like no advantages to these. I mean, the stage of the debate is so pitiful that if you say something like this, people will start explaining to you, A, why they like Twitter, or B, what they get out of it. And it's like, look, no one here has said you don't enjoy it. No one here has even said there's no useful things about it. What one's saying is that, like anything, let alone any kind of mass change in means of dissemination, communication, production, there will be pros and cons. And in my opinion, the cons are understated, and I am tempted to say, generally speaking, outweigh the pros. But, different people can, we can agree or disagree on that. But these things are distressing to observe when one observes them.
One more question along these lines, then I'll get back to listener questions, which is, what do you have a model for how, people always invoke the idea of comradely debate? I've never really seen I'm sure someone has at some point, but I've yet to see someone spell out what exactly that means. And just speaking personally, like, I really like the idea and wish that people on the left weren't at each other's throats all the time, but I found it impossible, for example, to be, super comradely, or to see it at a distinction among people on the same side, you know, when in the past I've interacted with people who, you know, identify as being on the left, but hold anti-migrant political views, for example. For me, that positions them as like not on the left. Yeah. But then a critic of me would say, well, you can't just like position anyone who disagrees with you as outside of the realm of comradely debate. But
yeah, but I mean, to be fair to you, I don't think you're doing that. And I mean, no, I don't have, I have kind of, if you like, internal slogans, you know, extreme suspicion when dealing with a political enemy, extreme generosity when dealing with a political friend. But I mean, that's very broad brush. There's always gray areas, of course, as you say, and I don't have a problem with that. And I think that I think it would be impossible to come up with an algorithm for how to be comradely. And I also think that there are, you know, there is a danger of the desire for comradeliness kind of tipping over into the liberal desire for civility. And I think, you know, there's been far too much civility in terms of debating with capitalism and so on. So I'm very pro comradeliness and sort of comradely debate and having a sense of scale. And the only thing I can say I try to do is, in a sense, precisely not to algorithmize. It's like everything is contextual. The way you might want to argue with this person, the way you might want to debate with this person depends on a lot of things. It depends on the context of the debate, depends what you know about them, depends on your judgment about their political good faith, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a constantly changing thing. And also it's important not to be dogmatic and to, you know, if you're going into an argument or a debate without even entertaining the possibility that someone might make some good points and make you think anew or change your mind, then you're not really debating. But these are obvious bromides, but it's kind of all I've got.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing I'll say on it, and I feel like this was inspired by a tweet that I read. I don't know by whom. So I'm attempting to cite whoever inspired this thought. But assuming that we're talking about not only like the broader left in this kind of like Twitter public sphere, but actually like within organizations that exist, to act with a sense of care for the importance and fragility of the organization one is a part of.
Yeah, that's very nice. I would add to that, and I know that you were using the phrase in passing, but I don't think it's unimportant. I would add to that, I do not think Twitter is the public sphere. And I think that the fact that we keep using that phrase is a triumph of ideology that we should really get over.
Well, can you actually expand on that briefly? What sort of sphere is Twitter? And is there a public sphere?
I'm gonna plead the fifth on this at this point, simply because this could really derail us from this discussion. Right. And I think that, you know, the discussion, what I would say is this, I would say as a shorthand, anyone who is interested in questions about the psychopolitics of, more the psychopolitics than the organizational politics, but the psychopolitics of the online sphere, whatever, if they haven't, I would urge them to read Richard Seymour's book, Twittering Machine, which I think is the starting text. Of course, there's also, you know, Shoshana Zuboff and so on. But I think for me, Richard's engagement with the kind of with the psychoanalytical approach, a kind of left psychoanalytical approach to what is going on when one posts is, and Richard is online, and this is not a kind of moralist finger wagging, is absolutely fantastic. So, rather than answer that question myself,
I point to a book. To look up Richard Seymour's work if they're not familiar with it. Also of Salvage, and who also has a wonderful, I feel like, almost daily newsletter. One of these people who writes at a pace that I can't comprehend.
Yeah, if you're not signed up to Richard Seymour's Patreon, I urge you to sign up. He's a close friend, but he's also, I think, one of the most important polymaths on the left, publishing outstanding stuff. And even if you don't agree, you're going to find it rigorous and provocative, and it will vary from eco-socialism to psychoanalysis to theology to trade unionism. It's indispensable stuff.
Back to the questions. In Spectre Haunting, you seem to be making a distinction between revolution and rupture. Can you say a bit more about how and why you want to distinguish the two concepts, and whether you think Marx and Engels would follow you in doing so? I'll add that I'm not saying you are distinguishing those, but I don't recall that being a distinction you were making.
Well, I think it's a really interesting question, and I'm grateful to the questioner because I mean, to some extent, I think I am. I think the question of, well, maybe I wouldn't say necessarily a distinction, but there's a they're not isomorphic. They're not identical, and I think Marx and Engels also make it clear that they're not identical. To answer the question, you know, do you think Marx and Engels would follow you in this? I mean, I don't know, obviously. I'm not having a go at the questioner. It's a perfectly reasonable question, but I do think like it's important to say, even if they wouldn't, doesn't necessarily mean I'm wrong. You know, like what Marx and Engels like quote really meant is obviously a very important data point, but it is not the answers to things. And I suspect, you know, there are times when they do use the phrases more or less interchangeably, but in the case of in the manifesto, they fairly clearly don't. They're clearly deeply closely related, but the use of rupture comes. They say the communist revolution is the most radical rupture with traditional property relations. No wonder that its development involved the most radical rupture with traditional ideas. Now, on the one hand, they're saying like this is that, but actually, when you look at the kind of I think the sort of sum total of the way they talk, what they're committed to is, you know, what Engel talks about, total social change. They're talking about, you know, the word, you know, brechen. It's like it's break. It's crack open. And what they're committed to is a breaking of the everyday. And what they're saying when they say the communist revolution, it is the most radical rupture. They're describing its relationship to rupture. It is the rupture. It's the most radical rupture, I mean. But they're not the same thing. Like rupture is essentially they use it. This is derived from the verb break, and you see this in Engels's work as well, in The Condition of the Working Class in England and so on. The thing to bear in mind is at more than one point, especially later in their late in life, both Marx and Engels speculated and ruminated on the idea of essentially creating a kind of social rupture, as in a complete break with the normality of the everyday, with capitalism, through non-insurrectionary means. They speculated about doing it legally or whatever. Now, when you start talking about this, some leftists get very, very nervous, because what they think you're doing is moving away from, you know, revolution, and you're becoming a left reformist, and then you're going to become a reformist, and then you're going to become a conservative and so on. Now, I accept that there is a well-trodden path on that. And as I try and say in the book, you know, I'm with Marx and Engels here, which is that, you know, they both say very clearly, like, it is overwhelmingly likely that the way to get the rupture is necessarily a forcible revolution. But what they do is they speculate under very certain narrow circumstances. What if you can reach a ruptural change without necessarily this thing called the political revolution in the same way? If anyone interprets this as me saying, like, we need to move away from a kind of revolutionary politics, I very explicitly don't say that, and neither do they. But I think there's something really interesting about the fact that for them, rupture and revolution are not 100% isomorphic. They discuss revolution as a way to achieve rupture, and they leave open the door for another way to achieve rupture under very, very rare circumstances. And I'm just really interested in this because I think there can be a kind of a danger on the left of a kind of abstraction of the notion of what a revolution is, the way it works. And therefore, anyone who says anything, who kind of opens the door to anything that doesn't look like a kind of, you know, to put it playfully, a kind of cosplay rerun of October 1917, is like, you know, betraying the spirit of revolution. All I want to do is say I suspect, you know, that Marx and Engels, until late in their lives, were open under extraordinary circumstances to the idea that there might be alternative roads to the aim. And the aim was total social change, rupture. That was the thing they never moved away from. They may have been open under these rare circumstances to the idea of a parliamentary road there, but if you didn't end up in rupture, you weren't getting to the right aim. And my feeling is simply, like, on an intellectual level, it is very interesting to me that the only person I have seen systematically start to tease these two things apart is Poulantzas, and even that very, very sketchily. you can agree or disagree, but he's one of the few people who actually starts that process. And merely intellectually, if you like, why are we not doing that job? Now, I would probably go further and say not I'm therefore advocating, you know, the parliamentary road to socialism, but I am very interested in the nature of the relationship between different political strategies and means and the final aim on which we need to be ironclad and unbending, which is total social change, which is Brecken, which is rupture from this invidious everyday. I should say, I know a lot of people disagree with me about this, but I and this is developed more in the book. But if nothing else, I'm pleading for a kind of intellectual open-mindedness to this problematic.
Well, I'm really more on, like, I guess I find myself more even on, like, the other side of that. You know, I find the idea of, like, an actual, like, violent revolutionary movement taking hold in the United States, let alone being victorious, just fundamentally incomprehensible. So I think, and I mean, at least, it, you know, or at least not like imaginable at the moment, and which I think then forces us to ask like precise, like really tough questions, like precisely what sort of like reformist or parliamentary politics can lead, like ultimately add up to something that would. Hypothetically, one day add up to a rupture.
I mean, you know, it's very interesting.
Too pessimistic, but doing the organizing I do on the ground here, it's like where I'm organizing tenants and doing organizing around housing work. I don't see where like a classic revolution along the lines of storming the Winter Palace would enter into that, except like as an abstraction.
I mean, I think when history changes, sometimes it changes staggeringly quickly. So I'm kind of like open to whatever, which doesn't mean that I think anything is particularly likely. I just like, who knows? But what I do think is interesting is, you know, for example, when you mention Poulantzas, now with the proviso that Poulantzas said various things and wasn't always consistent and so on, fine. But like, especially if you look at like his debate with Henri Weber, who was a more orthodox Marxist, there's a strange dialogue of the death thing from Weber, because Weber, who was in the Fourth International, is basically he sort of, on the one hand, he says, look, I'm not saying you don't have to work with the state, but what I'm saying is you need ultimately to have this fundamental rupture with the everyday, and if you don't have that, you're not really getting rid of capitalism. Poulantzas doesn't dispute that. Poulantzas, in fact, is the one who stresses you need a rupture. And he also says you're never going to get the rupture if all you do is work with the state. But then he says, I believe under these circumstances, you are not going to get a rupture unless you also work through the state. Now, you can agree or disagree, but the point is the tenets of the debate are rarely treated with the seriousness they deserve. Instead, it's just kind of finger-wagging reformist, ultra-leftist at each other. And this is unhelpful, to go back to our previous conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun to, it's like what we need are, you know, tough strategic discussions and debates where there'll be significant differences, but the question is a fundamentally strategic one. But instead, the way that they play out tends to be kind of indexical. Like what kind of person...
Right.
The argument that I'm making is supposed to reflect what kind of person I am.
And the reason I like... Oh, sorry, Daniel.
Oh, no, just either, you know, if I was making the debate from my point of view, it'd be like, you know, to be critical of myself, it would be like me proving that I'm like a serious, like, and practical socialist, whereas someone else would be like, you know, my opponent in that discussion would be like, no, I'm the actual revolutionary. But neither of us in that case are having a strategic discussion.
And one of the reasons that for me, the concept of rupture is so important is because what I will not bend on is that for me, you know, I do not think capitalism is fundamentally reformable. And therefore, for a world fit to live in, what I am advocating is a ruptural politics. Now, for me, as with Marx and Engels, I suspect that is to some degree, and whatever this means concretely, this means almost certainly means some kind of revolution. But we can bracket the specifics, or we can have that as a separate conversation. But if we're both committed to rupture, if we're both committed to saying this system has to be broken because it is killing us, then maybe that's a more fruitful ground for debate. And for to that reason, I think the non-distinction between revolution and rupture is a bit unhelpful on the left.
Right. Right. I mean, then there's a related set of questions. Even if we can all agree that rupture is ultimately necessary for either historical or ethical reasons. I talked about in the interview was like, yeah, Marx and Engels are making a normative claim about the ethical necessity. And almost their disavowal of making the ethical claim, I think, allows people to read too much into their kind of historical inevitabilism.
Yeah, I think that's right. I agree.
Okay, we can agree on like, you know, people can agree on rupture, but then there are questions like, for example, like the energy transition is happening in whatever way it is, in whatever contested way it is, at whatever contested speed that it is under capitalism. So what sort of like terrain of struggle does that open up if it is a reality that we need to decarbonize on a time scale that's faster than into capitalism is foreseeable? Complicated questions, but here is another question, which actually brings us, I think we set our little tangent there, set ourselves up well for it from a listener. Can you say more about salvage communism and what you mean by it, especially but not exclusively in relation to the climate crisis?
Yeah, I mean, this is developed more fully in the book, The Tragedy of the Worker, which I and Rosie Warren and Richard Seymour and Jamie Allenson on the Salvage Collective wrote. It was a short little book. I mean, essentially, just to be very brief, it's if you like, a sense of it's a sense of brokenness. It's a sense of like, full, you know, kind of luxury full communism. Now, I am not going to get involved in a kind of stupid kind of argument about it, because I think as a meme, as a provocation, it's great. But as a kind of, you know, blueprint for what we're aiming for in the immediate, I suspect it is unreasonable. Essentially, salvage communism is a commitment to the idea that, even if mirabile dictu, everything changed tomorrow, even if the rupture happened tomorrow, there is salvaging to do. There is work to do to redress, to live in a world that is in severe crisis, particularly, you know, ecologically. And of course, it's not going to happen tomorrow, and it's not going to happen, if it ever happens, it's not going to happen for some time, and this situation is only going to get worse and worse and worse. And in a sense, all it is, you know, we get into it a lot more in the booklet, but it's a sense of like advocating a clear-sighted melancholy optic about the job of socialism now being a job as much of repair and salvage as it is about wresting hold of and transformation and you know, building the means of production in that kind of very, very sort of abstract kind of broad brush way. And this obviously dovetails with arguments about degrowth, which are another argument that's been going on a lot. And I, for my money, it's, there are some really interesting and good points made on both sides, but I do think there's often a kind of dialogue of the deaf about this as well, in the sense that, you know, like some of the kind of anti-degrowth people accuse the degrowth people of like taking essentially capitalist accounting methods as given and advocating kind of moving in a different direction, but under given arena. And I don't think that's without trenchancy. I think some degrowth activists do indeed do that. However, I think that that is also implicit in a lot of the anti-degrowth literature, that sort of like there's a sense in which, because if all you're saying is we can't really know the way we're going to measure things like growth, stability, shrinkage and so on under socialism, fine. But that's not really what we're arguing about. And a lot of what these arguments are actually about is at minimum a kind of implicit sense that we will be able to do things which mean that we can have more stuff and continue, you know, yeah, by all means, we're going to kind of do more ecologically sensitive things, but we can just kind of keep building. That the notion of like limits is overstated. And I think that some of this stuff is kind of ideological. I think it's predicated just as much on a kind of given set of measurements as its opponents, although it doesn't seem to realize it. And secondly, if all it said was, we don't know, then fine. But it isn't saying that, mostly. And the fact is, and we go into this in the Tragedy of the Worker, even the most ferocious eco-modernist does allow for physical and ecological limits. Mm. Now, they may say they're like right out there, but they are there. And the moment you admit that they're there, this notion that basically there cannot be a carrying capacity
disappears.
There just is. So now what we're talking about is, where is it? Yeah. And this is where it gets to be a kind of best case guesstimate, you know, good faith interpretation of the data we have and so on. And, you know, on a certain level, it simply seems to me that, you know, you're not going to get to full communism the day after a revolution. You're not, you know, we have no idea what kind of things we're going to want. This model you're talking about a different notion of an enriched society seems to me to be extremely powerful and persuasive. But it's not going to happen overnight. And it seems to me at minimum that we need to be serious and open about the idea that repair in a liberated society may well involve like not producing as much stuff in the same way and having a different, you know, highly egalitarian, highly liberated relationship to like limits, but limits nonetheless. So it's that sense that, like, I suppose it is a fundamentally melancholy position because it's a position that says things are really bad. And it doesn't mean that one, like, wants to have a huge political fight with people who don't agree with us. We're on the same side that we want to change the world. But I am not at all sanguine about what it's going to mean in the, you know, if through our work and strength we actually win, there's an awful lot that we need to do. And that's okay, but I just don't see that there's any point denying that that can possibly be the case.
Yeah, I mean, I found the discourse to be like around growth, degrowth to be a rather, as you're suggesting, an unhelpful
point. Yeah.
Like, you know, personally, I feel like the Green New Deal framework did or does, depending on that, like, but the basic idea is that we can have different forms of abundance. I think the Green New Deal framework is a bit of like a messaging critique of the degrowth frame. It is hard for me as an organizer to imagine organizing around the idea of degrowth, even though I very much agree that we need less stuff that needs a lot of like mining per se. Like we need to radically reduce extraction, but that doesn't mean we can't have you know, a more kind of like service oriented form of of collective abundance, of green collective abundance.
Well, I mean, I don't actually disagree with that. And I think that, you know, anyone who is taking any kind of degrowth idea that sort of says, okay, we're going to need less stuff, here's a list of the stuff you're going to have to make do with less, is also essentially kind of making a blueprint for a future that we can't possibly know. But I do recoil somewhat from, and I think you're right, like there's various different notions of what a full life is, and liberated people are going to have a very different idea of what a full life is than unliberated people. But I do recoil somewhat from one thing which you said, which I also think is very, very common in this debate, which is, I find it hard to imagine how to organize around this. Now, you may be right about that. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I think that probably depends on context and who one's talking to and so on. But I think it's really, really important when we're having these discussions that we are clear about the distinctions between our strategic positions, our propagandistic positions, and our intellectual positions. Yeah. And I think a lot of the time in the degrowth debate, the line, this is unhelpful at the organizing level and this therefore can't be correct, gets elided. And that is a terrible way of arguing intellectually.
Right. I'm not sure.
If we think it's true, then the argument becomes strategically, how do we put this position forward? Whether or not, you know, but I'm not saying you're saying this, but I'm saying certainly a lot of the debate does do this.
Yeah. But these arguments are happening on Twitter, which is in public. So it's how do you... Or it's not the public, but
well, this is one of the great problems with Twitter is there's this idea. Not only is it the idea that this is the public argument that is happening, but there's also the notion that like this is happening and it is an argument and therefore I need to be part of it and respond to it. You don't.
No.
You absolutely don't. And there is at least a non-zero chance that it will be better if you aren't.
Yeah, it's a lesson that I learned many times years ago, and I'm grateful that I did. All right, well, this was fascinating, and it was enjoyable to do a looser, less structured sort of discussion than a typical dig. It was an experiment for me because I'm used to the highly, sure, highly controlled environment. So thank you for
thank you. And can I say my apologies to, we had some really fabulous questions that we didn't get to, and I wish we had a bit more time. And I want to thank people for those questions. Maybe there'll be another chance another time. But thank you. This was a lot of fun. I'm really glad we did it.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.